This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Detective Tony Leggett told a judge that witness Sarah Carbaugh described the man she saw walking away from the crime scene as muddy and bloody in a blue jacket. Remember that. Muddy and bloody and in a blue jacket. According to the defense's appellate findings in her actual 2017 interview, surprise, Carbaugh said the man was muddy. There was no mention of bloody. And he's wearing a tan jacket. A bloody man in a blue jacket matches Bridge Guy. A muddy man with a tan jacket does not. That difference is not a minor discrepancy. It is a difference between a witness who corroborates your theory and a witness who undermines it. And according to the appellant's brief, it was not the only thing Liggett got wrong in the probable cause affidavit that launched the entire case against Richard Allen. The search warrant for Allen's home, car, and electronics was issued on October 13th of 2022, everything the state built against Allen, the gun, the bullet comparison, the Carhartt jacket, the arrest itself, and every confession that followed traces back to this warrant. And the warrant is bad. The tree is poisoned from the root, and according to the defense, Liggett's affidavit was built on omissions and misstatements that painted a picture the actual evidence did not support. Give me your thoughts in the comment section as we work through this on Substack and YouTube. The links are in the descriptions. So here's what happened in September of 22. The misfiled Dullin report was finally discovered, and law enforcement investigated Richard Allen for the first time in 5.5 years on October 13th. Allen was re-interviewed by Liggett and another investigator. Allen was cooperative. He confirmed he'd been on the trail on February 13th, 2017, said he walked to the first platform on the bridge to watch fish, said he saw three girls, told him he didn't know what he'd been wearing that day. Could have been a Carhartt. Could have been a sweatshirt. He denied being Bridge Guy. When confronted with the photo from Libby's phone, Allen said plainly that if the video was taken with the girl's phone, there was no way it could be him. He also told them he didn't see anyone else on the trail, specifically not Bridge Guy. When investigators pushed harder, according to the defense, Allen corrected them, reminding them he'd said it could have been a sweatshirt, not necessarily a Carhartt. He pointed out that everyone in the community had been looking at the Bridge Guy photo for years. To him, it didn't even look like the man was wearing a Carhartt. Allen even challenged them. Good luck finding anything that points to that. He eventually had to get up and walk out at the end of the interview. He'd been living in the same small town the entire time, cooperating when asked. That same day, Liggett applied for the search warrant. And in his affidavit, according to the appellant's brief, Liggett told the judge that Betsy Blair described the man she saw on the bridge as wearing a blue jacket and jeans. He lied to get a search warrant. What Liggett left out was the rest of Blair's description, that the man was in his 20s or early 30s, youthful, medium build, with a brown poofy hair, a description that does not match a 44-year-old man with closely cropped hair. Blair's sketch, which she rated 10 out of 10 for accuracy in 2017 and 9 out of 10 in 2019, depicts someone who looks nothing like Richard Allen. But when you just grab a little piece here and a little piece here and say, hey, based on this, I'd like this warrant, and you misinform the judge, you might just get that warrant if that judge doesn't do their own homework. Because the judge never saw the sketch, and the judge never heard the full description. So the judge couldn't push back and go, yeah, we don't give warrants to search people's homes unlawfully that really don't have probable cause, because what you're bringing to me as probable cause, what you're bringing to me is saying this is a good enough reason to search this person's home. What you're saying the reasoning the crux of it is, is not it at all. You're lying. You're withholding pieces of information that would discredit your whole reason for trying to get this warrant. And if you were to say those aloud, you probably wouldn't get that warrant. But if you just don't tell the judge, are you lying? That's called lying by omission. To an idiot, you may think, I didn't lie. But when you're not sharing the whole truth, that is called lying by omission. In my opinion, and the opinion of those of us who practice common sense, the judge only heard that Blair saw a man in a blue jacket and jeans, which describes half the male population of Indiana on any given day. Liggett told the judge that Allen parked his black 2016 Ford Focus at the old CPS building, which he allegedly omitted was that Blair described the car she saw parked there as resembling a 1965 Ford Comet with sharp edges and a nondescript color that was specifically not black. Her sketch of the car looks nothing like a Ford Focus hatchback. A second witness, Terry Wilson, described the same car as the purple PT Cruiser or a small SUV-type vehicle. Neither description matches Allen's car. Interestingly, the defense notes that Liggett did include Wilson's inconsistent description in the affidavit. Purple PT Cruiser is not a black Ford Focus either. The point, the defense argues, was never that witnesses identified the car as Allen's. It was that a car was there, suspiciously parked. But what the judge did not know was that the only witness who also saw a bridge guy on the bridge, Blair, gave a car description that excluded Allen's vehicle. Then there was Carbro. Liggett told the judge Carbro saw a man in a blue jacket who was muddy and bloody. According to the defense, Carbro actually said tan jacket, muddy, no mention of blood in her 2017 interview. And Blair had told Liggett directly that the man she saw on the bridge was not the same person Carbro described walking on 300 North ISP. Itself released a public statement in 2019 acknowledging those were two different men. The agency that employed Liggett had publicly declared these were different people. And yet, according to the defense, Liggett's affidavit presented them as though they were describing the same man in a continuous timeline leading to Allen. Mold the evidence to where it serves you, I guess. Finally, the clothing. According to the appellant's brief, Liggett claimed Allen admitted to wearing a black or blue Carhartt jacket with a head covering, linking him visually to Bridge Guy. The defense argues Allen actually told investigators he didn't know what he was wearing that day, that it could have been anything from a Carhartt to a sweatshirt. When the investigators pressed, Allen reminded them he'd said it couldn't have been a sweatshirt. And when Allen's wife confirmed he owned a blue Carhartt in 2022, she also told investigators he'd purchased it a couple of years ago. It'd been years after the 2017 murders. Had the judge known Allen simply admitted owning a blue or black coat, as does probably every 50-year-old man in rural Indiana, the connection to Bridge Guy would have been pretty much meaningless. The defense argues those aren't inconvenient oversights. They argue Liggett misrepresented Blair's description of Bridge Guy, omitted that her car description excluded Allen's vehicle, changed Carbro's words from tan to blue, and added bloody, where she said no such thing, and attributed clothing statements to Allen that Allen never made. Every single alleged misstatement and omission pointed in the same direction, connecting Richard Allen to the man on Libby's phone, a pattern that, in the defense's view, goes beyond carelessness. The defense filed a motion to suppress the evidence seized from the search and requested a Franks hearing, a proceeding specifically designed to challenge a warrant when the defendant can show the affidavit contained deliberate or reckless falsehoods. Allen's attorneys supported their motion with depositions, police interviews, and reports. They cited the affidavit line by line. They filed a final motion urging the court to compare the affidavit directly with Blair's and Carbro's actual interviews. The trial court denied both the suppression motion and the Franks hearing, The defense notes that the court had been willing to schedule a Franks hearing when Allen was represented by different attorneys, but refused when the original defense team was reinstated. Allen's constitutional protections, the defense argues, should not depend on who his lawyers are. Without the search, there's no gun. Without the gun, there's no bullet comparison from state examiner Oberg, upon which the state arrested Allen. Without the arrests, there are no confessions from solitary confinement. The defense's argument is direct. The state's entire case is fruit of this warrant. And the warrant, they argue, is built on a version of the facts that could not survive contact with what the witnesses actually said. In 2022, ISP had no more evidence connecting Allen to the murders than they had in February of 2017, days after the crimes, when Allen walked into a parking lot and volunteered information. It was the same man, the same trail, the same time frame, the same car. The only thing that changed was how the evidence was framed in a probable cause affidavit. According to the defense, the warrant didn't rest on new evidence. It rested on old evidence presented in a new way, a new omitted way, with the inconvenient parts stripped out. The defense argues that if Allen, being on the trail within the same 2 hours the girls were abducted, were enough for a warrant, law enforcement would have obtained one for his home in 2017. It wasn't enough then. Without the omissions, the alleged misstatements, the defense argues it wasn't enough in 2022 either. Had the judge seen the full picture that Blair described, a young man with poofy hair who didn't look like Allen, that her sketch of the car doesn't match his Ford Focus, that Carbo said tan jacket and muddy with no mention of blood, that Blair and Carbo were describing different men according to ISP's own public statement, and that Allen never actually admitted to wearing the clothes Liggett attributed to them, the defense argues there would have been no warrant. No search, no gun, no arrest, no confessions, no case. Every domino that fell after October 13th, 2022, started with this affidavit. And every piece of evidence the jury eventually used to convict Richard Allen traces back to a document that, if the defense is right, told the judge a story the witnesses themselves would not recognize. The state disagrees. They argue the omissions were immaterial. That probable cause was sufficient based on Allen's own statements and the corroborating surveillance footage, and that even including the omitted information, reasonable probability still supported the search. The state points out that Allen himself told police where he parked, that Hoosier Haverstore video showed a car matching Allen's Focus heading towards the CPS building at 1:27 p.m., and that Allen's wife confirmed they usually parked at that location when walking the trail. In the state's view, the omitted details about Blair's physical description and car description do not remove probable cause, because the significance of that evidence was never about a positive identification. It was about placing a car at the scene and a man on the bridge during the relevant time frame. But here's the problem with that argument, at least as the defense frames it. The probable cause affidavit doesn't just place Allen on the trail. It connects him to Bridge Guy. Liggett's conclusion was not that Allen was merely present in the area. It was that Allen is the individual depicted on the Monon High Bridge from the video taken from Libby's phone, and is the last individual to have contact with the victims. That is an identification claim. And when the only eyewitnesses who saw a Bridge Guy face to face describe a man who looks nothing like the suspect, and the detective leaves that description out of the affidavit, the identification claim is built on a gap the judge was never told existed. The defense argues further that the fact Liggett made the same type of misrepresentation twice, attributing a blue jacket to both Carbro and Allen when neither said it, shows more than reckless disregard. It shows a pattern directed at one conclusion: putting Allen in Bridge Guy's clothes. An appellate court will decide who is right. But when the one eyewitness who saw a Bridge Guy on the bridge describes a man in his 20s with poofy brown hair, and the detective leaves that out of the warrant for a 44-year-old man with a crew cut, that's not a peripheral detail. That is the central question of identity in a case where identity is everything, and the judge never got to weigh it. your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. I'd love for you to weigh in, and we will continue our conversation there. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Richard Allen confessed to shooting Abby and Libby in the Delphi case. That's pretty damning, isn't it, right? Except they weren't shot. That's not how the crime went. It was a blade. Then he confessed to essaying them. Pretty damning too, right? On its surface, like, holy shit, he's confessed. Except there was no evidence of that. That didn't happen either. He also confessed while claiming he started World War III. Whoa! Whoa, whoa, whoa! So he shot these two girls, essayed them, and started World War III? This is a pretty bad dude, except none of those things have happened, at least as of this recording. He confessed also while believing he was dead. So he's a zombie. He started World War III. He killed them with a gun. And then there was SA involved too. Again, wow. Except none of it's real. Except these are delusional thoughts coming from a man who's been described by medical professionals as gravely disabled. He was also smearing himself with feces and declaring he was King Michael. Made 60 confessions during a period when prison doctors, again, diagnosed him as gravely disabled and very psychotic. And the Indiana Department of Corrections was forcibly injecting him with antipsychotic medication. Seems like a great time to take a confession and use it in court, right? Because I'm sure anything that's being said while someone is claiming to basically be a zombie, having started World War III, committed these crimes in ways the crimes were not committed, and being King Michael while being injected with drugs and eating your own poop. Seems like a great confession. That'll stand up in court, right? Here's the disturbing part. It did. It did stand up in court. That's the thing. Despite the defense saying, this isn't admissible, this is insane. This is a madman. You've locked him away in solitary confinement. You've violated the Geneva Convention. You violated your own state and federal rules on putting people in solitary confinement that have not been convicted of a crime. You tortured the man. You denied him access to his legal counsel. Or the autonomy of choosing staying in local jail or going to a federal prison, which you would have a say in, but you took that away from him too, Indiana. So you have all of that. And then he finally confesses after you torture him. But that little confession that you get, although not a confession to the actual crime, you're going to say, well, I don't want to say round and square peg because we're so far different here. It's not even a peg. This Buick, this 76 Buick should fit in through this little square hole over here, right? It's not even a square peg. It's a Buick. That's how different we're talking about here in this case of what they're trying to jam. And they tried to jam it through. They tried, all right. And that's why we're still talking about this case, because it was insane. The confessions they got were the centerpiece of the state's case against him. And in Indiana, apparently, that's all you need. That's all you need to convict somebody of a horrific crime like this when they have no record of doing anything of the sort ever. In fact, he volunteered and said, hi, how can I help?
Before I walk you through what happened in Westville, I want you to hold something in your mind. On October 13th of 2022, the day Allen was arrested, Detective Holman interrogated him for over an hour. You can watch the tape. According to the defense filings, Holman lied to Allen's face. He told him five witnesses saw him with the girls and a gun. He told him experts had identified him and his voice on the video. None of it was true because none of it happened. Holman pushed relentlessly. He even tried using Allen's depression against him, suggesting it was because Allen killed two children. That didn't work either. When Holman used Allen's wife as an interrogation tool after ISP had lied to her that the bullet matched her husband's gun, Allen hugged her and said, "It's going to be all right." Left alone with her, he said, "I am not going to say something I did not do, and I can't explain something I don't understand." He told her, "I know that no bullet from my gun was connected to a murder in any way, shape, or form." Allen eventually had to get up and walk out to end the interview. That was Allen before solitary. With it, concise, clear. A few days after his arrest, Allen, who's 50, arrested for the first time in his life, was sent to the Indiana Department of Correction as a safekeeper. IDOC transferred him to the Westville Correctional Unit, mind you, with no hearing and no attorney involvement, nothing. The maximum security segregation unit that corrections officers described as a place for the worst of the worst. This from a man with no prior convictions should not be in prison, number one. Jail is what that is for. The movies call it the hole. It's used mostly to punish. Allen was the first pre-trial safekeeper in any IDOC employee's memory to be placed there. The standard practice was to house pretrial detainees with mental health issues in mental health units. IDOC knew Allen carried a diagnosis of major depressive disorder. They knew he'd been hospitalized for suicidal ideation in 2019. He received a D medical health score, the second most severe, entitling him to one out-of-cell psychologist visit per week. During those visits, he was shackled inside a 3-by-3-foot cage separated from the psychologist by bars. That was his mental health treatment. Oh, and by the way, she was a big true crimer who was following the case. Hardly someone who should be handling this. The cell was 8.5 by 12.5 feet. Concrete slab with a mattress, camera running around the clock, bug infestation. His only view was a narrow window facing razor wire. Meals came through a slot in the door. He ate alone on the floor or his bed. There was no face-to-face human interaction unless he was shackled or separated by bars when they moved him outside the cell for showers, for attorney meetings, for anything. He was restrained with leg irons, handcuffs, and a belly chain on a lead. Guards with video cameras recorded him during showers and attorney meetings, allegedly. Suicide companions sat outside his door around the clock, documenting every word he said and every behavior they observed, regardless of whether he was on formal suicide watch, allegedly. IDOC's own policy restricts solitary confinement to 30 days for anyone with serious mental illness. The policy exists because decades of research acknowledged by IDOC's own internal documents show that prolonged isolation causes psychological trauma, psychosis, hallucinations, paranoia, and suicidal ideation, all the things you're trying to prevent, but you're actually creating an incubator for it. It happens in healthy people if you do that to them. Happens to anyone if you do that to them, really. A separate lawsuit against IDOC had produced an order and settlement agreement that expanded the definition of serious mental illness to include major depressive disorder. Allen's diagnosis. Under that definition, Allen's solitary confinement should have been limited to 30 days. If he decompensated into serious mental illness and was unlikely to return to general population for 30 days, the policy required a transfer to a mental health unit. But I guess policies aren't necessarily laws, is what we're learning here. Standards are only standards. They're not rules. IDOC did not apply the restriction. When Allen exhibited the predictable symptoms of deterioration, administrators refused to transfer him. The court refused to move him. The prosecutor collected his confessions. Allen remained in the most restrictive cell in the most restrictive solitary unit for 13 months. And if you see the fuckers who did this to him at the local Piggly Wiggly and go, oh, thank you for your service, you're a great officer, maybe you should think twice about that. I'd think more like opening up the can of Coca-Cola, putting a Mentos on it, and pointing it directly at them. That's just me. And I'm not saying anyone should do that to any of them, soaking them in Coca-Cola fueled by Mentos. Ooh, how horrible that is. But my God. How does anybody look at the authority figures, the investigators, the police, the people who are making these decisions in this case and go, oh, these are great folks. These are great salt of the earth people that we really want serving and protecting. They're still in place there in Delphi, a town which there's no way in living hell I will ever set foot in. And I'm sure some of them are like, good, good. Well, good news for you is we're letting everybody know just what a shithole Delphi is and why you may never want to live there. And I know it looks real pretty. It looks quaint. It looks like a nice little small town. It'll probably be a ghost town within the next 20 years with the amount of lovely publicity that we're giving it. The amount of people who might see this and go, yeah, maybe not. Maybe not. Maybe this isn't where I want to call home. Sorry. Unless you do something about the folks that are running your little town. I think we'll make it part of our mission to let everybody know why you don't want to set foot there. Good, we don't need more people. Yeah. Until your economy's gone, more than it already is. Within 2 weeks, Allen told his wife he was broken. Told her that if it became too much, she should call the detectives and he would tell them whatever they wanted to know. It wasn't a confession. It was a man describing the terms of his own psychological surrender before it happened. He was telling her in plain language that the conditions were already more than he could bear, and he wanted to relieve his wife of all of this, all this pain, all this suffering. He was willing to take the blame if he could lift the suffering that she was experiencing, which was a fraction of what he was experiencing from the outside, saying he'll say whatever to make this stop. Senator John McCain, who survived a prison camp, once said solitary crushes your spirit and weakens your resistance more effectively than any other form of mistreatment. Allen entered solitary confinement with a compromised mental state. It had been 2 weeks. Had his confinement been 30 days or even 90, the defense argues he would not have decompensated. But it was 13 months he was there. By April of 23, 5 months in, Allen weighed 135 pounds, came in at 180. He was psychotic, gravely disabled, confusing nightmares with reality, claiming he'd started World War III, playing with feces, declaring himself King Michael. Days before one of his confessions, he was too disjointed to hold a conversation. IDOC began involuntary administering antipsychotic injections between April and late June. Early cell videos show Allen pacing his cell, lying down, doing leg crunches, writing, reading, looking distressed, but coherent. By April, coherence was gone. And the confession started pouring out. Over 60 to guards, to his psychologist, Dr. Walla, to his family on record recorded phone calls. He confessed to shooting the girls. They were killed with a blade. He expressed uncertainty about whether he'd essayed them. There's no evidence of that. He got basic facts of the crime wrong. The state collected all of it, monitoring and cataloging his statements, consumed hundreds of hours. ISP interviewed inmates and guards and even sent a psychologist to speak with Dr. Walla while confessions were ongoing. The prosecutor sought Allen's medical records, videos, and all communications while confessions were still happening, if that's what you want to call them. Most would say the ramblings of a madman, but hey, when you need a confession, I guess, you know, you could call it also ordering lunch from the Hello Deli. He didn't order lunch. Yes, but if we're calling that a confession, it was also a lunch order from the Hello Deli with Rupert G. In 1997,
That's what he was doing too. That's not at all what he was doing. You're right. It also wasn't a confession. When Allen's defense attorneys filed an emergency motion to transfer him, citing his rapidly deteriorating mental state, the prosecutor waited 9 days to respond. During those 9 days, according to the defense, investigators were monitoring Allen's real-time phone calls, calls in which he was confessing. When the prosecutor finally responded, the filing described the defense's concerns as colorful and dramatic. That same day, IDOC's own records designated Allen as gravely disabled. The court refused to transfer him, putting the onus on IDOC to provide care within the same facility that was causing the actual deterioration. Why do you think they don't want him to be found innocent? Because all of these people in this circle who did this to this man will all be found guilty. And they all have lives to lead and families to take care of, families who supposedly love them, families who I hope watch this video and make a calculated choice to distance themselves from their loved ones. Sometimes you got to cut the cord. I'm sorry if these people involved in this story who did this to this man are somebody that you thought was somebody else, or maybe you've always kind of suspected they were kind of shitty. Well, here's your evidence. Probably the social distancing from these individuals that hopefully they're experiencing from their loved ones, from their friends, from their families, will take effect at some point and be far more damning than anything the legal system could do. Because I'm sure the legal system will not catch up and hold most of them responsible. All that can be done is social shaming and people who are around them that once saw them in a different light truly see them for who they actually are. In my opinion, these are allegations, it's my opinion. So there you go. Dr. Walla controlled all aspects of Allen's life in the cell, whether he got bedding, clothes, meal items, books, personal items, utensils, all of it flowed through her. She could provide a new window or a tablet or strip him to bare necessities, allegedly. According to the defense, after Allen confessed to Walla on May 3rd, he asked for his property back, and her notes indicate she told him she needed more consistency. Whether Walla had ill intent is irrelevant, the defense argues. What matters is what Allen thought, what solitary confinement was doing to him, and the fact that his basic comforts depended on the person he was confessing to. The confessions to his family happened on recorded phone calls and investigators were monitoring in real time. On April 3rd, he fell on the floor, asked if he was dead, and was suicidal. On May 10th, he believed he was dead, that the world would blow up if he slept, that his water was poisoned, and that he was reliving the same day over and over. On May 17th, he was paranoid about attorneys and staff who he believed were who wore Odin patches. Yes, Odinism. On May 25th, he paced for 2 hours and banged his head against the wall. On June 11th, he thought he was in hell and did not understand what was happening around him. These are the circumstances surrounding the confessions the state presented to the jury as evidence of a free and voluntary admission of guilt. In Indiana, they can torture the shit out of you. And this is a voluntary admission of guilt. Only in America, as Brooks and Dunn would say. Allen's first confession to his wife included the words, "I think I did it," not "I did it," "I think I did it." The defense called Dr. Grassland, an expert on the psychological effects of solitary confinement, who testified that false memory starts with a belief. When you're isolated long enough, when you're treated as though you are guilty, you begin to think you are. The social isolation of solitary makes people question their sense of their self, their memories, their grasp on what is real. In Allen's first confession to Dr. Walla, he was unsure if he had S with the girls, got the facts wrong. He confessed to crimes that did not occur. He never once confessed to the actual crime. There is no confession out of Richard Allen that actually matches the crime. It's not the pattern of a man recounting what he knows. It's a pattern of a man whose grip on reality has been deliberately, systematically shattered by conditions, that his own institution acknowledged would cause exactly this result, this discombobulated delusion, which is what it is. But they didn't want it to be that, so they called it something else, a confession. These are the supposed sane people that are doing that part. Who's crazier? Dr. Westcott, a forensic psychologist who conducted a 127-page evaluation of Allen, concluded his psychosis stemmed from his major depressive disorder, his personality, and the well-documented effects of prolonged solitary confinement. Objective psychological testing ruled out malingering. Allen was not faking. By August of 23, he could not remember weeks of his own life. He could not remember confessing. He was terrified, unsure what was real, wondering if he was dead, in hell, or waiting for heaven. The defense argues this case, it presents a simple question with a clear answer. Should the state be able to benefit from Allen's psychological pain that their own deliberate indifference to his mental health caused? IDOC knew solitary would harm him. Their own policies prohibit it beyond 30 days for someone with his diagnosis. And when the predictable deterioration occurred, they refused to transfer him. When his attorneys begged the court for relief, the prosecutor mocked their concerns. On the same day, IDOC designated Allen gravely disabled. And then the state used the words that came out of that broken man's mouth as a centerpiece for a murder prosecution. Almost every guard who testified at the trial claimed Allen's bizarre behavior was orchestrated and not the product of genuine mental illness. And most of those people are also not qualified to work at a closed-down family video, which is why they're working there as a guard in the prison system. So spare me a moment while I don't take their psychological evaluation as having any merit at all. One dipshit guard said he knew Allen was truthful in his confession because he looked him in the eye. He looked me in the eye. Some claimed inmates commonly smear or eat feces as a tool for attention. Is that what they're doing? Hey, why is it you're a prison guard? Now, I guess some people, I guess, love the job. And if that's you, that's you. But a lot of people take that job, and I've seen it in my own world, in my own life, with people I know, because they couldn't get other ones. Because that was all the community offered as employment. And because a lot of those people didn't want to go anywhere else or do anything else. They wanted the paycheck. They wanted to show up. And look, I'm not trying to shit on prison guards here. But I'm also not going to treat these ones like they're fucking psychological professionals. Like they're some sort of expert that's going to give us some sort of insight into the mind of Richard Allen because he looked him in the eye. No. Sorry. Have it your way at Burger King. There you go. That's your next lateral move. None of these guards were mental health professionals. None knew Allen's mental health classification or could probably understand it. None had the training to distinguish malingering from genuine psychosis. I say put some of them in their solitary for over 30 days and see what happens. Let's see how quickly they start eating their own shit, having it their way, putting a little ketchup and mustard on it, calling it a whopper. Dr. Westcott, who did have that training and who administered objective psychological testing designed specifically to detect faking, found no evidence of malingering. The state asked the jury to trust corrections officers' gut feelings over a 127-page forensic evaluation backed by standardized testing. Yeah, those damn experts, those smart people, we don't need none of them. They looked, he looked the guard in the eye. That guard knew what it was because Jesus said it was real. What? I'm telling you. We're living in the upside down. Idiocracy is taking hold. And the jury, who never heard the audio of what Allen actually sounded like during these episodes, who never saw the video of him pacing his cell or banging his head or failing, falling on the floor, flailing, had no way to judge for themselves whether the guards or the psychologist were right. It's all presented as fact. The state used those confessions to convict Richard Allen. How solid do you think they were? If you're like, there's got to be more to this. I mean, really? I mean, there's a lot more to the story and to the whole case, but everything I just gave you there was probably one of the most detailed accounts that I've ever done on this show about his experience in solitary confinement, and it's all fact. Now, you certainly got my opinion mixed in there and how I feel about the people who did this, but what happened to him, those events that I spoke about of Richard Allen and what he endured, all fact. If you are okay with it, I guess, you know, go on to the next kitten video or whatever you're watching. If you're angry, share this. Comment. Let people know this ain't okay, because right now the state of Indiana is, Richard Allen has been convicted. He's in prison. He's dying in prison. And the clock is ticking for this man to be able to get out. I'm doubtful he ever will. And the state of Indiana would be very happy about that, because if anything changes with this man's conviction, all of these people are in for a world of hurt. Let's bring them the hurt, shall we? Share this. Give me your thoughts. Let people know this is going on. We'll continue our conversation in the comment section. Until next time, my name's Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.